On today's episode of Chapters.
I felt this really strong voice speaking through me, and I felt like, oh, actually, this is probably like my two talents, like my talent to communicate with anyone and my talent to write have been combined, and it's magic.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/chapters. There you'll find over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today my guest is Jacqueline Suskin, a writer and performance poet based in Los Angeles. She's the author of two books, the latest entitled Go Ahead and Like It, available from 10 Speed Press. Known for her multidisciplinary work with a project she calls Poem Store, Suskin composes improvisational poetry for patrons who choose both a topic and a price in exchange for a unique verse. Poem Store has been her main occupation since 2009 and has taken her around the country with her typewriter in tow for weddings, parties, speaking engagements, residencies, festivals, and more. Suskin has been featured in the New York Times, T Magazine, the LA Times, The Atlantic, and various other publications. She's collaborated with fashion brands, finding endless ways to bring poetry into the mainstream. Suskin is the editor-in-chief for the Dilettante Paper Book Series. She also has the honor of being a member of Turnaround Arts. This is her story. So I usually like to start by asking people to tell me a little bit about where they're from and what their earliest memories of reading are.
Yeah, I was obsessed with reading when I was a kid, and I grew up in the Florida Keys, but I was born just outside of Detroit, Michigan. And I mean, I just have memories from even then when I lived in Detroit of writing lots of strange, cryptic language and filling up journals with, I guess, with poems and stories, but, you know, before I really even knew how to write. So that also, you know, coincided with listening to a lot of stories that were read to me, but then getting into reading at a really young age and talking at a really early age. So I think the first book that I remember being, you know, fully obsessed with and, you know, grown up enough to read on my own without an adult helping me was Harriet the Spy.
Oh, wow.
I loved that book so much. And I think there was something about that book that really touched a chord in me, because she's so focused on details and collecting all these details. There was another book that was similar called The Pig Man, which it was just about these, you know, young kids who would kind of go into these strange settings with, you know, people, grown-ups, other kids who maybe were not like the most likable, or, you know, who were ostracized, but that they would, you know, strike these kind of unique friendships with. And it's interesting because I think about how that's affected me and how I've then, you know, learned to lead a life that is definitely, you know, dedicated to kind of nurturing very unlikely friendships. So from a young age, those books were the, you know, the highlights for me.
Can you say more about that? What kind of unlikely friendships do you mean?
Yeah, I think a lot of what I do with my work with writing poems, you know, because I'm doing this practice of Poem Store where I write poems on the spot for people with my typewriter, it sort of enables me to connect with anyone. And I think maybe when I read those stories at a young age, I was like, oh, see, these people can also connect with anyone. And that's magic in life. Like, the magic is to be able to connect with any kind of person. And I think I felt that at a young age, but then have continued to kind of see that be my strong point in life. You know, throw me into any situation and I can kind of openly and deeply communicate with just about anybody.
That's quite a gift.
Yeah.
It is, really. When you were reading Harriet the Spy, when I think about that book, and I don't know if I'm remembering it correctly, but she's gathering clues and running down leads in part because she has a hard time connecting with other people. So being a detective is kind of a cover for her or something that helps her explain why she holds herself apart. Did you kind of, were you interested in that because that wasn't your experience?
Well, I was an only child, so no matter what, I was sort of held apart, just because, you know, I was alone all the time. So I didn't have siblings to distract me or to spend my time with. So I was kind of the master of my own little universe. Even with my friends, I was always the one who was like, okay, we're going to play this game. I came up with this weird idea by myself and these are the characters that we'll all be. And, you know, which maybe to some would seem bossy and to others would seem like a relief.
Wow. That is a very only child kind of mentality. That's great. So what kind of kid were you? Were you writing poetry and reading books a lot?
Yeah, I was absolutely writing all the time as a child. I still have all these notebooks and stories. And I mean, I was obsessed with the TV show Beauty and the Beast, just mostly because this was like, you know, it was Linda Hamilton and Ron Perlman and this Under the City of New York, and a very strange show for a kid to love. But I think it was, again, like this person who was sort of an outcast, and yet I was like, oh, I could love that person. And just like, you know, Linda Hamilton loved him. So I wrote a book of poems dedicated to Vincent from that show.
Whoa. That yeah, is deep.
It was deep. I still have that.
And I love that.
It's so incredible to me that a person in third grade would kind of, I mean, clearly I thought that he was real, you know, and I do have memories of thinking like I had my own connection with him, and I pulled characters out of stories all the time and sort of just, they were real to me. And I don't know if that's, you know, hand in hand with being an only child or just being, you know, a person who likes to create stories. So I just, I was always writing, always had a notebook, always drawing and, you know, creating a lot of poems when I was younger, before I really knew that they were poems. And then by the time I got into middle school and, you know, poetry was brought up in class, I was like, oh, I'm a poet. That's what I am. And I remember, you know, having this lesson that we had to kind of create an example collection of different types of poems, like different forms, like a sonnet and, you know, what is a couplet and this and that. And I opted to write all of my own instead of just seeking out examples. And I'm sure my teacher was like, whoa, this kid is ambitious. And then I just did it in sort of no time flat. And I know that was like a turning point for me to kind of recognize like, oh, I'm a little different with the written word than the other people in my class. No one else wanted to do that. So
Do you remember reading poetry as a child?
A little bit. I mean, I kind of consider a lot of kids' stories, especially the classics, to be very poetic. You know, a lot of them have rhyme built in, and the way that they're just sort of short and to the point can be really poetic. But I think also, you know, my dad probably exposed me to poetry at a young age because he's a very well-read person. So.
Hmm. And were your parents shaping your reading tastes, or when did you kind of diverge, if you did, from their tastes or suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they, like most parents, had, you know, their hand in kind of bringing the classics of, you know, just children's literature into my life. And then there was also just my strong desire to read. So books like Harriet the Spy and things like that came through me just kind of wanting to be in the bookstore and see what, you know, what had come out and what was new. So I was definitely like hot on the reading tip, even at a young age, probably more than I am now.
So where do you go in your reading life next after Harriet the Spy?
I mean, I kind of think that what came after that would translate better into like my middle school life, because that was the book from my childhood that I just kind of, that I have still, that I've kept. There are lots of other books that I read as a kid that helped shape who I am, but I think in middle school I really started to get like overzealous about reading, and I read 1984 when I was in like sixth grade, and I read every single book that J.D. Salinger wrote. Which is not that many, but as a child, it was really so depressing that he had not written more, because I kind of just became, I think I must have been in eighth grade when I read those, and I just was obsessed with him. I loved this world that he opened up, you know, somehow, and I've read all those books again as an adult and think, wow, I wonder what made me feel so connected to the world of J.D. Salinger. These people were absolutely nothing like me. I mean, like, I was living in the Florida Keys. I was poor. I, like, knew nothing of aristocracy. I knew nothing of New York City. I don't know how, like, any of that touched the chord in me that it did, but there was something there that was, like, otherworldly and of another time that, like, really resonated with me as a kid, and I was just so obsessed with J.D. Salinger, and when I finished those books, I remember I was actually depressed for a while. My mom would be like, what's wrong? I'd just be like, I just can't believe that he didn't write more. Just like such a strange move for a kid in the Florida Keys. I don't know what I was up to, but
to be depressed in a way, reading the books like turned you into one of the characters in one of his books.
Totally. I think I was probably already, like, you know, dipping into my first bout of depression at that age. So I think that was probably honestly what, like, I was like, oh, this feeling that I feel is being described in this really beautiful and potent way. Maybe I'll dive deeper in there and see what that's about.
Was middle school the first time that you consciously were aware that you were depressed?
Yeah, for sure. It was like after my parents had divorced and we moved and I had started this whole new life in the Keys, and it was just kind of, you know, a shock probably for a kid that age.
Yeah, and especially to go from, were you in Michigan, to go from Michigan to the Keys? That's must have been quite a change.
Right, like, and being pretty, like, you know, middle class, kind of, like, you know, stable, to being like, hi, we live in a trailer park, and, like, you know, things were definitely... I didn't know that we were poor for many years. I didn't recognize that because we lived in the Keys. So my whole life was, you know, my face was in the water all the time. I was always in the ocean. I was always catching fish and lobster, and we kind of ate like kings and queens because we could just, you know, get our fresh food from the ocean. So it helped me not know that I was, you know, living in this strange, different world, you know, monetarily at least. But then, you know, I think a kid that age really feels whatever their parents are going through. So I think probably a lot of, you know, my feelings and then my, like, reading choices were based on that, like, sense of understanding of what was really going on there. You know, it wasn't just like this sunny lifestyle. There was a lot of heartache involved.
So it's interesting then with Salinger, because in a way, when sometimes people... So I study something called bibliotherapy, which is the use of books as medicine. And the people who practice that have two different minds about how you should prescribe a book or a poem to someone who's going through something. And one school would say, if you're going through something difficult, you should absolutely prescribe something that is like what the person is going through. So if you're depressed, you should read about someone who's depressed so you can feel a kinship with them or recognize yourself in the book and feel less alone. And the other school would say you should read something that brings you outside of yourself and offers an escape. So for you, it's like Salinger kind of did both, because you have this like crazy fantasy New York life that I couldn't identify with either. But then also this kind of, I think those books are powerful because they offer people in middle school or however old you are when you first encounter them, a realistic depiction of kind of being depressed and that being an okay thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that probably for most of my reading experience, I definitely lean towards finding that thread of whatever it is I relate to in the story. And I think that, like, as a writer, then my kind of response to that is to take that feeling of accessibility and, like, really amp that up. Like, I want anyone to be able to read what I'm writing and find something in there that touches them. And I think that I appreciate that in literature. Like, oh, here is this beautiful through line that really, like, speaks directly to my experience. And now I know I'm not alone. Or more than that, when I was young, I was like, wow, not only am I not alone, but I'm just like this really famous, amazing writer. Like, I remember being a kid and thinking, like, wow, like, I feel the same things as Hermann Hesse. Like, what, how is that possible? You know, like, that really made me believe in myself. And I think, like, you know, moving forward with my own writing is, like, kind of just translating and transferring that exact same sensation of being like, yeah, I feel the way that you feel. Like, we're all in this together.
Yeah, totally. And especially when you're in middle school and you're kind of at that tender age of just starting to figure out who you want to be and what you're all about and all of that, books can kind of be a safe space to kind of work that those kind of questions out. So what else was kind of in your world at that point?
Well, I think like following all of that was, you know, just in high school, I became obsessed with John Steinbeck. And I mean, my favorite novel of all time is East of Eden. We didn't read that in high school, but we read Grapes of Wrath. And I remember being in my, you know, AP English class, and I'll just never forget this. And I had an incredible English teacher, Mrs. Valin. She was like just so, so special and really recognized like my devotion to the written word and was really a really nurturing teacher in my life. So one day in her class, you know, these are like supposed to be the smart kids. These are the AP English kids. And I was selected to be in AP English because I was in a regular English class and we were, what were we reading? We were reading Gilgamesh or something. And the teacher was talking, and this is not Mrs. Valin, this is another teacher. And she was talking and she said some kind of statistics, some sort of like, you know, percentage, a quote she was talking about. And I raised my hand and I was like, I'm sorry, you just said all those numbers, but like, where did you actually get that quote? Like, where are those statistics from? And she was like, ladies and gentlemen, did you just hear Jacqueline ask this question? She deserves to be in AP English for that question. And wow. She literally like pulled me from the class and put me in AP English because she was just so impressed that I had asked where the statistic came from.
That's amazing.
So then I mean, she, you know, probably in that moment changed my life because she put me in this AP English class, and then we're reading Grapes of Wrath, and you know, we get to the final, like the final scene of that book, which is so powerful. And I'll never forget, you know, all these AP English kids were like so confused by that last scene, and they were kind of like making fun of it and like asking some sort of like, you know, sexual questions about it. And I just like had enough. I don't know. It just really, you know, I remember I slammed my hands on the desk and I stood up and I was crying and I said, this is the most beautiful moment and such an important piece of literature and you all are just fools. I ran out of the classroom. And, yeah, I really had a visceral response to their kind of just inability to connect with something. So, and I realize now, you know, I see that that's an uncomfortable scene, you know, where she's like breastfeeding this man to keep him alive. And it's just like, I think just then John Steinbeck just became like such a part of who I was. And he's since like, you know, still I have paced myself reading his work because I don't want to have that Salinger effect where like I finish everything and then it's so
over.
Sad.
I don't
want it to be over.
Why do you think his work is so important to you? Like, what did it touch in you when you were reading that book and ever since?
Well, you know, East of Eden, I read when I was a little bit older in college, and I just, I felt like the way he could capture not only like lifetimes, you know, more than one lifetime, an entire like lineage of a family, but also of place, and, to also tie in like biblical, you know, importance and just the craft of it blew my mind so much. But then like also so much of the human condition wrapped into that. And then, in the last year or so, I read the journal of a novel that goes along with East of Eden. I don't know if you've read that, but it is.
No, I haven't.
Oh my gosh. So every day Steinbeck wrote, a letter that went along with, you know, went along with the manuscript when he would send it to his editor. So it's this letter to his editor every day. And it was basically his way of kind of warming up. And when I read the journal of a novel, I was like, oh, I know why I love Steinbeck so much, because I am Steinbeck. Like, I'm literally like reading his journaling, I was like, oh, I see now all along why this person has been so important to me, because he thinks about writing and being alive in the world, and he feels things so similarly to me that I must just have felt that kinship even before knowing that.
Can you think of a letter he wrote where you thought, wow, I feel that exact same way about writing or being alive? Or...
Yeah, there's one. I mean, first of all, the idea of him having that connection to his editor and like having like that frankness before he gets into his work, like letting him kind of like let his own voice just flow out a little bit as he's getting ready to write this epic novel that covers so much of, you know, American history and time and space, and his connection to California too. So I have such a strong connection to California, but he wrote a lot about like what people were doing with their lives in that time. And mainly, I think the thing I connected to the most in the journal of a novel was his approach to like the practice of writing and the discipline of writing and how difficult and challenging it is to sit down and just be a writer every day. Mm-hmm. And how, oh my gosh, I mean, the process of him like, you know, forcing himself and like putting himself in that situation and then, and coming out with all of this incredible work and being so prolific, but kind of you would look maybe previously at someone like that and be like, well, wow, they just really knew how to be a writer. And it's like, no, you read this novel and you're like, oh, nope, he's struggling just like me, like just trying his best to like sit at his desk and make sure he does the work, and how to be a father and how to be like a community member in the midst of that kind of like intense creativity that comes out of like the depths of his soul. So.
Wow. It sounds like you have an intense connection to him.
Yeah, I do. I do.
In a good way, in a good way.
Yeah, yeah.
For our Chapters listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. If you visit audible.com and sign up for a free 30-day trial, you can download an audiobook for free. Why not check out East of Eden by John Steinbeck, a book that significantly impacted our guest Jacqueline. She doesn't want to finish reading Steinbeck's books because she would hate for that period of discovery of a treasured author's words to end. With this recording of East of Eden, you can discover and savor Steinbeck's prose for over 25 hours. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/chapters. Again, that's audibletrial.com/chapters for your free audiobook. Now let's get back to the show.
So what happens next for you? You're in high school. Are you any other important reading moments in that time or before college or whatever the next stage might be?
Well, I guess the chronology maybe would be best to go to Elizabeth Bishop, because Elizabeth Bishop single-handedly decided where I would go to college, which is pretty incredible, because I got some scholarships to go to a few different schools in Florida. And so I went, you know, visited them, and I was at Florida State in Tallahassee, and I sat in on a poetry class because at that point I knew that I was meant to be a poet and I was not going to study anything but poetry. Even though my mom was trying to convince me that I should be an accountant or a pharmacist, but I don't, I was like, Mom, I just don't even know how to do math. I don't know how I would, I don't know how I would do that. So I sat in on this class, and this teacher read an Elizabeth Bishop poem, In the Waiting Room, which is from her book Geography 2. And that poem, In the Waiting Room, it just, I mean, the poem itself is kind of about pausing time and falling through time. And I absolutely like paused time and fell into this space of knowing that that is the exact school that I was supposed to go to and that there was no way I was going to go anywhere else. And I'd never heard of Elizabeth Bishop before. So then after that, I just, you know, went and got all of her books and started just diving into her history. And she became kind of the first poet that I was
just really dedicated to. I mean, I had been in love with Walt Whitman for many, many years before that. And so he is actually the first, but she was the first female poet, and she was also the first poet that I had never heard of. You know, Walt Whitman was, I felt like a household name, mm-hmm. but Elizabeth Bishop was something I had never even heard anyone say that name before. So it was like a revelation for me.
Wow. And I was going to ask how you knew you wanted to be a poet, or before you went on that visit, before you had that like really kind of magical encounter with her poetry for the first time. And is it because you were reading poets like Walt Whitman, or was it because you found yourself writing poetry and just felt that this was something inside you?
Yeah, I could just tell that that was what came out of me in the most natural way. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to spend my life doing something, it should be this thing that I love that happens so naturally for me. You know, I it was definitely more of that I was already writing poetry and, you know, just breaking into like the world of what it meant to be a poet. And sure, like Walt Whitman, you know, shines a huge light on what it is to just even be living in the world as a poet. And then I think making a career out of a poet, you know, out of being a poet, wasn't something that I had really thought through. I was just like, I want to study poetry. I don't know what it means to be a poet in this day and age. And, you know, everybody would continuously tell me throughout my time at Florida State, you know, you the way you're a poet in the world is you are a professor. And I graduated and was like, not me. I was just like, nope,
not for you.
I'm gonna do it differently.
So what did you, I mean, do you want to say any more about your college years and reading before we get into that choice to not be a professor, to be a poet in a different way, in your own kind of way?
Yeah, I guess the only other thing I would think about, and I'm not sure when in the chronology this happened, but when I read William Carlos Williams for the first time, which I might have actually been in high school, and I read The Red Wheelbarrow, mm-hmm. I just had this moment, and I think maybe this is like a universal moment with that poem, if you really, really get it, that you're like, oh, I see how my perspective is the perspective of a poet already, you know, like to hold this one moment as this beautiful, powerful moment and just put it down on the page and give it to everybody. There is something in that that was so liberating for me, that was like, oh, I don't have to, you know, be overly wordy to get the point across. And that kind of like, you know, maybe like took a leash off of something for me.
Yeah, I remember reading that poem in high school, and I don't know that I understood it at the time. Maybe I still don't. Mm-hmm. I think I'm still waiting for that transformational moment.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I think it's like him just saying, look here, like this detail. That's the world is alive with poetic moments. Like you are surrounded by poetry. Every detail, and especially ones that come together just like that, it's like a photograph almost, you know? This is just this moment that's been captured in a poem, but similarly to a photograph, this image that, is just a gift, like all of these slight, beautiful things coming together at this exact moment. I just think that's so perfect.
Wow. Well, that does make sense to me. I'll have to go back now and reread that poem and think about that.
Yeah.
So when you leave college, I think you had people told you to be a poet, you had to be a professor, and you rejected mm-hmm. that. So why did you reject being a professor?
Well, I really just wanted to travel. At that point, I was like deep in the beatniks. I loved every single sense of beatnik lifestyle and was just like, well, that period of time is over, but I still get to see the world. And instead of like following this like pre-prescribed line of, you know, graduate school and getting my PhD and that, I'm going to go and I'm going to see the world, and I'm, you know, I'll just write along the way. And so I did. So I traveled for a really long time. And then, you know, there are many books that I read while traveling. I feel like
I read Demian by Hermann Hesse during that time and felt, you know, my like spiritual self was really like on the rise in that time. And I just read, you know, things that were kind of out of the ordinary. Like I got into Anne Carson and I read Autobiography of Red, which that book really shook me because I felt like it was just so different than anything I had ever seen before. I read Rilke and was just like, I was just full of this inspiration of being kind of like on a different path. I just didn't feel like I was meant to just follow the rules and do this, you know, kind of simple thing. I was like, oh, I'm more interested in seeing the world than I am, you know, playing it safe. So I went to Central and South America and I lived in Seattle for a while. I went on a crazy like trip across the country where I studied permaculture and which meant I read a lot about the natural world, and I've always been a very earth obsessed person. And so like reading a lot about the natural world and being connected to, you know, farming and all of that brought Wendell Berry into my life and Mary Oliver. And those are my one favorites. So like, yeah. You know, me traveling and like having my hands in many different types of dirt around the, you know, around the country really also like helped me dig out the type of poets that I now feel the closest to and feel such a kinship with, which are, you know, these naturalist poets. And I feel like, you know, I also read Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and ended up like, you know, just living this really kind of radical lifestyle where I just, after traveling, I ended up moving to, Northern California up in Humboldt and, you know, growing tons of food, and I ended up living off the grid on this beautiful land project. It's called Fancy Land that my friend runs, and I was the gardener there and did a lot of writing and reading there. So fell in love with just like that whole concept of, you know, I kind of feel like that's where I developed my purpose as a writer. Like, I always knew that I could touch people with words and that I had been, you know, touched by these many different novels and all these different poets because of things that I could relate to with like the shared story of, you know, the human condition. But then I thought, oh, but I can actually heal people with my writing, because this is when I started writing poems for people in public. And there was a healing that was happening. And instead of just thinking, oh, I have this like great gift to heal people, I was also like, oh, if I heal people, if I help people feel better, if I help people connect to like, you know, the divine or whatever it is that comes through poetry, then they will treat the earth better. And really all I really care about is the earth. I want the earth to be okay. Like I want us to do a better job, you know, taking care of the earth. So I somehow, became fully lit with this like sense of like purpose and duty that I could not only heal people, but by like helping them with poetry, I was also helping the planet.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like your desired interaction of a reader with your work is the same reaction that you've had as a reader to other people's work.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be inspired, to be environmentally conscious.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if I'll ever write, you know, a giant, incredible novel that, you know, spans the whole of this country, or like, Another novel that really affected me similarly to East of Eden was Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner. And that those works move me in such a widespread way, but I've also seen my poems move people in that way, where I'll write something for someone and then many years later they'll write me and they'll be like, this poem instigated this entire story that changed my life. So
whoa.
I kind of feel like, oh, I can do it. I can do that in my own way, through my own work.
So to go back, can we maybe talk a little bit about when you first started this project and how this all began?
Yeah, I started Poem Store in June of 2009, and that was kind of like right before I moved to Humboldt. So it was on the very end of my long, long years of traveling. I think I traveled for like 4 years or something like that. And in the midst of that, I would stop and work places. And so one of the places that I stopped was in Oakland, Oakland, California, and I was just kind of meeting up with some of my like punk friends there, and they were like, you should meet this guy. He's a poet also. And he, you know, he's just like this scrappy punk guy, and he makes a living writing poems on his typewriter. I was like, what? I want to meet him. So we went over to this little, party, and there he was. His name is Zach Houston, and we totally hit it off. He's, you know, talks a million miles an hour, super eccentric, like very strange and clearly a genius. And, I talked to him for a really long time, and he at the end was like, well, do you have a typewriter? And I had just purchased a typewriter in Los Angeles at the Rose Bowl, like the day before. And he was just like, well, you should come out with me. And I was like, this is just so, it just felt like fate, you know, like I had weirdly purchased a typewriter as someone who's a traveler, which is such a strange thing to do. You know, I've refrained from having a record collection because I've traveled so much in my life that, you know, why would I buy a typewriter? But I just did. I just bought it on a whim. And sure enough, like it fit right into the story. And I went out with him, you know, to type at a street fair in Oakland the next day. And the first poem I wrote, I was just like, oh, whoa, this is something that is way bigger than just a writing experiment, which is what I thought it was going to be. Hmm. I knew immediately, like, the depth that I had hit with this woman who asked for this poem. This is the first poem I wrote. She asked for a poem about heartbreak. And then she said, not the regular kind of heartbreak, but like when you look back on your whole life and you think of all the places you couldn't live because you couldn't live everywhere, and all the people that you didn't love because you can't love everyone, and all the things that you didn't get to do because you can't do everything. And it's just heartbreaking.
Wow.
Wow. Holy moly. Like what? And I, you know, went right into a poem and I read it to her, and she cried, and she just held my hand, and she was said, you know, thank you so much. This is exactly what I needed. And I just knew. I knew right then that it was something so special. I had no idea that it would be my career. I just did not, that thought didn't cross my mind at all. I mean, it didn't really come to my mind for like a year after that. I moved up to Humboldt and I started typing poems at the farmer's market, and you know, people would just pay whatever they wanted to for a poem, just a donation, and tell me a subject. And I would, you know, just come up with these off the cuff poems. And it felt at first totally like, okay, this is a cool way to keep my writing practice going. And also just to give myself some space after traveling to like make some money and engage with people in this new town where I live. But it really quickly revealed itself to be so much more than that. And just, I felt this really strong voice speaking through me, and I felt like, oh, actually, this is probably like my two talents, like my talent to communicate with anyone and my talent to write have been combined. And it's just, it's magic.
Has there ever been a time when somebody comes up to you and asks for a subject and you feel stumped in some way?
No, that's never happened.
Wow.
That's never happened. Not in my 8 years of doing this.
Wow. Can you remember any stories of, I'm just so fascinated by these stories of interactions you've had with people. I'd love to hear some more of like, I don't know. I mean, you can pick any way you choose. I don't want to say the most interesting, because I imagine they're all interesting in their own way, but you know, any ones that have been like significant for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They definitely touch on that thing that I was saying before of like these unlikely friendships. Like just really, you know, a person that walks up to you, you can never, ever, ever judge anyone. You just really can't. And it's my work has totally reinforced that. It's just, I've written poems for all different types of people. And I think, you know, my best story is the story of my friend Neil Ewald, who came up to me and is just like, you know, a regular looking older man, like, I have no idea who he is. He's wearing a Hawaiian t-shirt. He's like, you know, just a guy. And he asked for a poem about being underwater. And I could tell, like, when people are kind of skeptical of what I do at first. And I love that, because it just gives me, like, this great, like, you know, arena to prove them wrong.
Yeah, so
like,
totally.
I write him this, you know, epic poem about being underwater, and he just, you know, I can tell he is really shocked by it. And then, you know, he pays me $5 and leaves, and that's that. But then I got an email from him the next day, and he was like, you know, I think it was really fate that I met you. I've been trying to find a way to commemorate my wife. She passed away 2 years ago, and I've wanted to, you know, read something or play a song or do something for her when I put her ashes in the ocean, but I haven't been able to find anything that was, you know, really like good enough for her. I don't want to just pull a song or a poem off the internet or out of a book. Like, I want to have something that's just hers. And then I met you, and I would hope that you would write this for me. And so, I mean, of course I said yes. And this, the way that he wanted me to engage in this process was to read all of the like emails and notes and letters and things that she had exchanged with her friends and family in like the months before she passed away.
Oh, wow.
Like, this is just, he was like, this is how you'll get to know who she is. And I want you to really know who she is. And so I did it, and I read everything. And
what was that like for you to read basically a person you've never met, but enter their life?
Yeah, it was really intense. I mean, she was an incredibly strong and just so pure and so full of love and just, you know, so compassionate and selfless and just had so much to teach everyone in her life and just such a grounded, beautiful way that it was actually like, I mean, it was super inspiring to read, but also just so heartbreaking. And, you know, so I've read all this and I've felt all these things, and then I write the poem, and I reach out to him and I say, okay, you know, the poem's ready. Like, maybe let's meet up, or, you know, how would you like me to deliver it? And he writes me back, and he writes me back from a different email address. And this is the first time that I see that he is the senior vice president of Green Diamond Timber, which is the largest timber company in California. Very highly, highly controversial. I've communicated previous to meeting him with many like tree sitters and radicals of Earth First. You know, they have this whole movement of trying to like save the old growth redwoods, and they really, really villainize this company, cause they own all the forest. And so my nature is never to be like, oh, this person's a terrible person. My nature is always to be like, I want to know. I want to know what the truth is. And so we get together and we have this, you know, beautiful bond over the passing of his wife and my knowing all of these like intimate details before I knew anything about who he was. So I already feel so close to him, and I read him the poem, and we have this whole moment, and it's just like the most beautiful thing. And so striking up a conversation with him about his work felt really natural to me. And he was so excited that I wanted to like learn about what he was doing in the world, and that I wasn't closed off to him, that he invited me to this like walk through the forest, and I got to like meet all these people and ask all these questions. I was so out of place. You know, I'm like this weird like hippie punk with like tattoos. Like, for some reason I'm like engaged with like all these like forestry businessmen and like loggers. But that was kind of how our friendship began. And honestly, he started just to ask me all these questions about how could he change the story of being this like dehumanized like villain in this community, where he was like, actually, I'm so open to anyone's ideas. You know, like I can't shut down our business, but if people have better ideas for the way we could work, I'm all ears. Hmm. And I got him to read all about permaculture. We had a book club, and like, I read all about, you know, mycelium and the way, yeah, just like things that were just, you know, clear to me. Like, this person is so open to growth and expansion. And I told all the Earth First kids about it. I was like, listen, like, you guys are wrong. Like, this man is totally open and incredible. And if I were you, I would approach him and try to like make something happen instead of just like sitting up in your trees and, you know, throwing down your hatred. Like, why don't you like, you know, extend a hand and see if you can make change that way. And luckily one of them did.
and he communicated with Neil, and they came to this amazing agreement. And Neil basically handed over this olive branch that was like, listen, like, we will make a deal not to cut any of these trees if you can, you know, see this as a bridge between us. And that to me was like the greatest thing that my poetry has ever done, which is, you know, preserved a forest and like created this like different kind of connection between, you know, people who were polar opposites, and could find some sort of middle ground.
That's an incredible story. And I'm just like, I'm just like thinking about this. This is nuts. Like I can't, but so beautiful that really the olive branch in this story is your poetry. And it just kind of opens me up to thinking about, obviously I'm predisposed to thinking that reading can serve all kinds of purposes in our lives, but it seems like it became like an olive branch between two groups that couldn't have been on, you know, more different in certain opinions, but it brought people together. And wow, that's incredible. I'm wondering, I know you share your poetry on social media. I love your Instagram account.
Thanks.
It's such a bright spot in my day when I stumble on one of your poems in my feed, because it seems like we're living in a time when people, generally speaking, have the ability to talk past each other, but not to one another, and like just a negative space. And social media can get really negative. And your poetry seems to really connect with people for a lot of reasons, but because it's so positive.
And it's about, I really, I want to bring the light. Like I don't want to ignore the darkness. I think you can do that at the same time, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, I think about that line, like I dwell in possibility. Like that's what I think about when I read your work sometimes, that it's very open. And I wonder if you experience as the poet interactions with readers differently online than you do when you're doing an event in person.
Yeah, I think it's, somewhat similar. I mean, I've actually found like a really nice way to feel connected to, my followers on the internet because I see their responses so clearly. And a lot of those poems are poems that I will write for people in person and then end up being like, this poem is actually for everyone. It's important for me to take a photo of it, or, you know, just the sense of like, these lessons that we're all learning. I mean, I can really say from all of my years of working on this project and writing, you know, over 30,000 poems for people in public, we are all going through the same things at the same time, always. Like everyone is struggling with the same things. Everyone is happy about the same things. Everyone's working toward the same things. It's, you know, the human condition is this connected, ongoing thing, and we feel so removed from each other, but we just aren't. We're really like in sync, and we're all really trying to like, you know, heal the same wounds. And I think that like by utilizing social media, I'm just maybe like reminding everyone of that, or like trying to like connect that in a larger way.
Yeah, totally. I wonder if when you're interacting with someone in person, if they come to you and say, I'd like a poem about X, and in your conversation with them, you realize that they might benefit from a poem about something else. Do you ever intervene in that way? Or, I mean,
Sometimes, yeah, I'll throw in like whatever I think, you know, should be in there. But, to be like not too like mystical and strange about it, but I don't really know what happens while I'm writing those poems. And so whatever comes out for them is usually just the right thing for them. And I really trust in that part of the process, because maybe it's just like, you know, having them be present, but also like just the energy of the moment. Like I get a lot of poem orders on the internet, and people, you know, are not standing in front of me when they're asking for a poem over the internet. So I can't feel them in the same way. But I think then that might be a moment where it's just like, okay, well, now I'm going to tap into like the collective unconscious and about this idea, you know. And I have yet to have someone say, this is not, I don't like this poem, or I don't want this poem, or, you know, this isn't the right thing for me.
Are you open to talking about what you think happens when you write a poem? Like, where do you think your gift comes from?
Yeah, sure. I think part of it is absolutely just like I said, that I have this ability to be connected to people. And through language, you know, I can feel that sense of connection and then immediately kind of translate what I'm feeling through words. And so a big part of it is just the fact that people really need to be seen, and I'm there to see them and translate what it is that I see to kind of provide proof that I see them. And then I think there's this whole other part of it that is sort of beyond me. And, you know, you can kind of call it whatever you want, like I'm channeling something, or there's some sort of psychic energy happening there. There's some kind of like, you know, unspoken exchange that goes on. Cause a lot of times I kind of, you know, slip into this strange little fast trance while I'm writing these poems, and they come out in like less than a minute, you know, they're really quickly pouring out of me. And so for me, I'm like, oh, that seems like, you know, sometimes it's even more clear that, oh, this is a voice that is not just my own. I don't know what that is, you know, like you could call it many things. I'm sure there are many words for it. And I feel pretty comfortable not needing to know exactly what it is. I think whatever it is just so beneficial and beautiful, that I just let it do its thing. I read some book a long, long time ago called, The Language Older Than Words. And I remember that book really affected some of my writing for a long time. But I do think that it is removed, like you're saying, in a way also, because, I mean, more than I consider myself with this project of Poem Store to be just a poet, I consider myself, you know, to be a healer. And that's, like, not something that I want to lead with, because I don't want to distract from the, like, beautiful thing that happens with just the exchange of poetry. It's so nice to not have to be like heavy-handed and even let people decide whatever it is that they want to call me. You know, like I'll be like, oh, are you a psychic or are you clairvoyant? Or I'm like, you can call me whatever you want. Like, I don't care whatever works for you.
It's interesting because we're living in this time when to be a healer, air quotes, a lot of people would expect or need to rationalize your skill along some kind of science and need some kind of like accreditation to invest your work with meaning. Or if you call yourself a healer, people expect that you have some kind of expertise that's legible in a certain part of society. But I think what's so valuable about your work is that it stands outside of that and it refuses explanation. And sometimes people can't really wrap their heads around that. Like I consider Mary Oliver to be a healer, and I don't know that, I think that might be difficult for some people to think about poets as healers if they only live in a world of, say, science.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mary Oliver is just the best example of someone who has found a way to, like, bring that realm of the natural world and the written word into the most accessible format. Like, she just wins as being the most accessible. And it's funny because I've watched, she's been my favorite poet for so long, but to watch her have this, like, almost like a resurgence. I don't know if you've noticed that, but, like, you know, she just came out with these other books, and I feel like she's had this great resurgence, and, like, it's so clear to me why that would be happening right now, because I think people are really struggling with their connection to the natural world. They see that we have disturbed and harmed it. And even if they don't notice it directly, they feel it. And to have someone like her bring that sensibility into such an accessible form of language, it's mind blowing, you know, like, and that is why she is like my biggest inspiration, because for me, like, you know, she's a great example of someone, my mom could pick up a book of hers and read it and get something major from it. You know, anyone could. And I think that's like, that's so rare in the world, especially of poetry, because a lot of times poets are aiming towards an esoteric language that is unique and avant-garde. And there's, I mean, I love that and I get a lot from that. But as a poet myself, and especially as someone who considers like my duty to like heal people, then I'm like, someone like Mary Oliver is really doing the best work, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. How do you think your work fits in with other poets working today? I mean, do you see yourself in conversation with them? Or are you kind of standing apart from them, doing your own healing work?
No, I think like Poem Store and my work with Poem Store is different than like I have a new book coming out this month, and it's definitely like a book of poems. It's different than my Poem Store poetry. It's much more personal. It's much more like following the tradition of like narrative poetry and less about like, you know, the specifics of healing one-on-one, which is totally what Poem Store is. You know, I'm writing these poems for one person at a time. And then this book is more like, you know, I had my friend, who's also a poet, because I feel like very connected to a community of poetry in here in Los Angeles. Lots of poets that I love and respect. And, you know, one of my friends, Wade Riff, he's like just, he's a very talented poet. And he, you know, said something about my book, which he was like, you know, this book is going to take people to a place where they need to go right now. And I was like, that's amazing, because that feels equally healing, you know? So I'm glad that like my other work as a poet can also stand in that realm of healing. And I think that that is true for a lot of poets that I connect with. You know, my friend Mandy Kahn she's my favorite poet in Los Angeles, and her work is so healing. And another friend of mine, Jeremy Radin, I read with him all the time, and his work deals with loss and, you know, transformation. So I think like the heart of Poem Store and those poems, although that form is very different and very performative, you know, I almost consider it a performance art more than I do just straight up poetry. Or like a healing performance art, you know, it's like, yeah. I think that, my other practice is what sometimes I call a real poem. I call them my real poems. You know, when I write a book, I'm like, well, that actually falls into the same setting. Cause it doesn't stray from my purpose, which is to, you know, illuminate the beauty of life and help people feel more engaged with it.
Hmm. And what kind of poetry or what poets work, if any, do you turn to heal yourself? Like,
oh,
if you're
well,
healing
definitely
others.
Mary Oliver and Wendell.
Yeah.
yeah. Definitely Mary Oliver. Definitely Wendell Berry. You know, I love Louise Gluck. She really moves me deeply. And I think like revisiting poems again and again that have moved me is the thing that I do quite often. So that again would be, you know, like all of these volumes of books that I've had for ages. But I just started reading John O'Donohue, To Bless the Space Between Us. Mm. And that's a book of blessings. And I feel, you know, like things like that, like I gravitate towards, I'm working on a book of prayers. Mm. And my friend told me to read this book, and it's definitely like in that same sense of like, you know, this is a book of blessings and they are beautiful poems, but they also like kind of reinstate like that sense of awe and anything that can, you know, I'm kind of just a person who's in awe all the time, just in a constant state of awe. And I think that anything that kind of nurtures that or, you know, answers to that, I think, you know, I love reading like Lew Welch. He's one of my favorites, and I love him because I know about his life and I know that it was really hard for him to be alive. And in moments when it's really hard for me to be alive, I'll turn to someone like that and be like, yeah, yeah, I see. I know what it's like, you know? And then I'll read, you know, some other poem like by Mary Oliver or something and think, you know, but I'm going to keep going because like, I'm not going to give up.
That's right. There's that great Mary Oliver poem. I can't remember what it's called, but it had, imagine someone watching the waves and someone goes to the ocean with all of their problems and the waves say back, like, excuse us, we have work to do. Like, in other words, yeah. You just have to keep going. Like,
get over it. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not about you. There's bigger things happening.
Yeah.
Hmm. So do you think about your poetry as a spiritual act in addition to healing?
What was that?
Do you think about your poems as a spiritual act in addition to healing?
Oh, yeah. I think the two go hand in hand. I mean, whenever I'm talking about healing, I'm definitely talking about, like, my own spirituality and my own sense of, like, being connected to this story on planet Earth and, you know, being totally devoted to, like, this strange mystery. And honestly, just I have such a deep appreciation for being alive, even though it's really hard. I'm just so amazed by it. Like, what is this? You know, what a strange, difficult, and perfect gift it is. And I think that my spirituality really resides in that practice of just being grateful to be anything at all. So that comes out through my work a lot, I think.
Hmm. I don't know how to top that, so I feel like I should maybe end there. But do you have any poems that you would recommend to our listeners who are just getting started reading poetry?
Oh my gosh, In the Waiting Room by Elizabeth Bishop. I mean, that poem really, like, there is not another poem that changed my life more than that poem.
That's a big recommendation.
Yeah, that poem really did. And you know, I still go back and read it, and I'm just like, wow, what she really did something special there. So yeah, for sure. In the Waiting Room by Elizabeth Bishop is my top recommendation.
Well, thank you so much. And where can we check out your work?
Yeah, I mean, you should be able to find my books on my website or anywhere on the internet, but my website is yoursubjectyourprice.com, which is a hilarious website that is connected to my work with Poem Store, because I really care about you being able to pay whatever you want for a poem. I think that's really special. And so there's poems there, and you can order poems there, but also, you know, my books are connected to that. And like I said, I have a new book coming out this month, so I'm really excited about that.
And what's that book called?
The Edge of the Continent.
Great title.
Thanks. Yeah, it's all about living in California. So there's three volumes, and this is the first volume, which is called The Forest.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to check it out.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank our guest, Jacqueline, for sharing her story with us. I'd also like to thank our technical director, Taylor, for all of her help. You can check out Jacqueline's work at her website, www.yoursubjectyourprice.com. You can also check out her poetry on Instagram at jsuskin. You can find us on Instagram at chapterspod. There you'll find shelfies submitted by our guests. You can find us on Twitter at chapterspod. You can find me at marymahoney123 and Taylor at mjtthephd. Visit our website, www.chapterspod.com, if you'd like to share your story on Chapters. You can also find links to every book mentioned on this and every episode on our website. Follow our page on Facebook, and you can get updates on the show and join conversations about each episode with other listeners. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us in the iTunes store. It really helps listeners find our show. Thanks for listening.